Let's hear some of that movie chat. Credits roll by and I tip my hat. Credits roll by, wanna know more right away. Let's have some of that movie chat. Credits roll by, tell me who did that. Life in the credits is where I wanna play.
Welcome to Life in the Credits. This is the show where we learn about entertainment by chatting with people who work in the industry. I'm Susan.
And I'm Ben. And today we're discussing the film Searching.
And joining us today is our special guest, Jane Wagner. So welcome, Jane.
Hey, Jane.
Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. So, Jane, can you get started today by telling us a little bit about what you do in the entertainment world?
Yeah, so I'm a documentary filmmaker, and I just premiered my debut feature film, Break the Game, which I directed, produced, shot, and edited. So many hats, more hats than I probably would have liked. And then as my day job, I direct, produce, supervise a nonfiction reality series.
Yeah.
Excellent. Well, nice. Congratulations on your debut.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Thank you.
So can you tell us a little bit about your path for this career, like what your educational background is, some things you did in college or maybe just outside of college that helped you get where you're at today?
Yeah, so I have like a little bit of a strange path, which is that I went to film school. I went to NYU Tisch my freshman year, and I actually ended up transferring out to a small liberal arts college, Davidson College in North Carolina. So a little bit of a backwards way, I ended up saving $60,000 in the process because Davidson had actually had a financial aid situation, but I figured I would still be able to have a career in film and television, but I'd have a more well-rounded education, the real college experience, and I'd end up back in New York anyway. So I studied art history at Davidson with a film and media studies concentration, and I didn't really veer into like a different career path. I did internships over the summers. And then it's kind of embarrassing, but when I was in high school, I went and saw a film, a documentary film called After Innocence, about people who've been wrongfully incarcerated in their life after coming out of prison. And it was a really moving experience. There were many participants from the film in a Q&A afterwards, and the producer, this guy Mark H. Simon, was there, and I like shook his hand and met him and wrote about it in a really cringy way in my college application essay. So then after college, I saw a posting for an internship with this guy Mark Simon, and I was like, oh my god. And I, in my cover letter, I quoted my college essay. Cringy.
That's awesome, though.
That was like my first job out of college. It was kind of a different day of internships where you really did like everything. And I was like doing it all hours, no money, but I gained like so much experience and came away with it as like a post-production coordinator and an archival researcher. After a few months.
Okay.
Cool.
So what is an archival researcher?
So an archival researcher, typically you'll find them on like a documentary or a nonfiction series that has materials like newspaper clippings or photos or newsreels or historic footage. So for this film that I worked on called Unraveled, it was about a Ponzi schemer named Mark Dreyer. So I was finding photographs, news footage, and then also working towards either licensing it or claiming it as fair use.
Okay.
It's a job that people don't really like to do.
Yeah.
But I really enjoyed like tracking down hard to find materials. And I found that taking that position allowed me to kind of get in on different projects early on. And ended up being a big part of my documentary career, working on a film that employs tons of strange materials. So it turned out in handy.
Yeah, that sounds cool. It sounds like a really good job for someone who loves doing historical research too, especially if it's any kind of historical documentary, those skills. Yeah.
So how did you work your way into actually creating your own film?
Well, I was working in TV and it was great. I'd always wanted to make my own film, but I didn't really have like a story I was dying to tell. until one day I was playing N64 over like a winter break and I couldn't beat a boss. So I just went on to YouTube and searched how to beat it. And I saw all these videos about speedrunners beating the game super fast using all these weird glitches. And it completely blew my mind. I was like, this is super cool.
Yeah.
Next video. And then I came across the participant in my film, Narcissa Wright, doing these legendary speedruns of Ocarina of Time in like 18, 19 minutes. And I was like, oh, this person's like a celebrity of this weird world.
Yeah.
Like back in 2015. So like the idea of people watching someone else play video games was kind of like a novel idea. I hadn't really seen that before. They had like their own language. I was like,
yeah,
okay, this is cool. Why is this person so loved? So I like searched her and saw that she had actually transitioned about a month prior and was live streaming. So I like went on her stream. I think it was like the first, like, I mean, I guess I had like seen a live stream or two, but like I'd never really like gone to a single person's live stream.
Yeah.
Right. Right.
And it just hit me instantly. I was like, this is like the future of where media is heading. Like it's so much more immersive. Like I'm like here with this legend live. Like I could ask her anything I wanted to, but I didn't because I was like, like, oh my God. And also I'm like, my internet archetype is a lurker. And it was like the future of relationships. Like there were friendships between people in the chat. People had parasocial relationships with Narcissa. I had my own, I developed my own. And I knew like instantly it was a documentary, but I didn't really, I like reached out, but like not really that earnestly. Like I think like I sent her a Twitch message. And then I saw that she wanted to make a comeback with the game, The Legend of Zelda Breath of the Wild. So it was like, okay, this is going to be a story no matter where it goes. I need to reach out now. So I sent her a Twitter message and embarked on a 6-year journey.
Wow.
That's wild.
Kind of going more broadly, what is it about documentaries and then also the reality TV area that like appeals to you that made you want to work in that versus, you know, other types of entertainment?
I think what I really like about nonfiction is that you can wear many hats and you can be truly involved in like every stage of the process. Whereas in narrative, there are like so many departments, there's so many people involved. To really get into it, like it seems to require even more luck, even more time. Whereas on jobs, after being an archival researcher, I was like an associate producer and then a producer. And like, I'm there from beginning to end. I have my hand in post. I have my hand in the field. I can actually like, as a producer, you're really kind of directing in some scenarios. And I do really like kind of like going through all these materials and finding out all this information and figuring out how do I turn all this real stuff into a story and kind of figuring out the puzzle, which is very much figured out in the edit, whereas narrative is really figured out ahead of time in the script. So that really like, I like a puzzle. I like lots of details and kind of figuring something out. And also the chance of like, especially with my film, I didn't know what it was going to be at first. And it changed and it was like very exciting to be along the ride. And like, for example, there is this whole love story that came out in the film that wasn't a part of it when I started it.
Yeah.
So it's just like, you really have the chance to harness serendipity in a really exciting way.
Yeah, that's cool.
So when you're making your documentary, how much footage did you actually capture?
Well, it's interesting because so I started filming with Narcissa about a week or so before The Legend of Zelda Breath of the Wild came out. So it was February 24th, 2017. I remember these things. and I made about 10 or 12 trips out to Portland to film with her. So probably, I want to say like 150, 200 hours. But I used almost nothing of what I shot and ended up using and staying in the world of her live stream. And for that, I had about 3,000 hours of, I suppose you could call it archival footage, but like it was, it's not like I got like this whole like big dump of you know, all the 3,000 hours, like it was coming out as I was filming with her. So that was like really formally, really interesting to me. Mm-hmm. Like, were these live streams archival materials? Yeah. Were they self-shot verite?
Kind of both, right?
Yeah, that's really
kind of both. I was watching a lot of it live.
Yeah.
But then I also going back into it. So it was kind of formally really interesting to me, especially as someone who started in archival research. Yeah. Right? I thought of like one of my favorite filmmakers, Brett Morgan, who takes these massive archives often of like people like David Bowie or Jane Goodall and creates these intimate scenes out of the materials rather than just using it as like evidence or wallpaper. So that's another thing that like really inspired me while making my film.
Yeah.
Cool.
So what was the day-to-day like working on this film with Narcissa? Obviously, a lot of that footage that you didn't shoot, how did you work that into the storyline? Did she have influence over the story or was she just the subject? How did that all work?
Well, it's interesting. Even the word subject has become, it's kind of almost become a taboo in the documentary industry. And the word that is most often used is participant or protagonist. Yeah. And I think that's really beneficial because it means that the people who you're making films about, they have some agency in the matter. And using these live streams, I mean, it was my initial impulse was to use her live streams as much as possible.
Yeah.
But it was so unheard of back in 2017. People were like, you can't just make a film of someone like on the computer and like, that's obscene. Like you have to like get her out of the room. Like this isn't cinematic. This isn't cinema. So that's part of why I filmed so much with her, but it felt the most authentic and the most genuine when it was in her world and she had control. I was never in the room when she was streaming. That was her own space. She was in control of the camera. She decided when to stream, when not to stream. She decided what footage she gave me, what she didn't. So I consider her very much like an author of the material. And she, when I showed her cut of the film, she really responded to that and thought this makes it really feel more genuine and appropriate. And I like really appreciate that.
Mm-hmm.
In a similar way, there's like a lot of back and forth and like with animation, like there are depictions of her as a child. So kind of sharing materials, but without. This film really captures a really hard time in Narcissa's life. So there's also figuring out the story. In this case, it felt like inappropriate to bombard her with like, here's a cut, here's a cut, here's a cut. Because it's like rewatching that is not a fun experience for her necessarily. So it was finding the right time for her to watch the film and also making sure that she had whatever support she wanted to accept to prepare her for the process of watching the film and in case you needed someone to talk to afterwards, because it's a heavy film and a heavy time to have to like reflect on. So, and I think that also in line with like looking at documentary participants in a different light, like that duty of care towards your protagonist is a really new up and coming topic. Like it's always been important, but it's a conversation that the industry is really having now more in earnest in their roles, like mental health supervisor, which you'll start to see that credit come up more in documentaries.
Nice.
Interesting. So how much of the film did she capture in the moment that you used, or did you pre-plan, or was there a mixture? What was that balance like?
I think the film is the film's like 72 minutes, and I think maybe 15 of it is footage that I shot.
Okay.
Her streams are also buttressed with animation, pixel art animation, and screen life graphics, so that it like guides you along on this journey and fills in her backstory. So it's not like I just like took excerpts of the live stream, but the phrase like leaving it all on the cutting room floor, like I left most of it on the cutting. Yeah.
Of course.
The cutting room floor. And it was funny because I called my director of photography, Justin, before Tribeca. And I was like, when you see the movie, it's going to be kind of weird because you're not going to see any footage that you were there for until like pretty much the last few minutes. Yeah. And he's like, you know, whatever makes it the best film possible. And that's kind of how I felt as the footage over time came out and came out of the film. But it also like really informed the way the story came together, like my experience of having a relationship with Narcissa and really knowing her and having her trust, so that when she did leave the live stream and I was there to capture it, I had that trust. Yeah. And she was very comfortable, and it was like I wasn't even there. So it worked out. Like going through that process really did work well and inform the rest of the film.
Yeah. You got to do a screening of Break the Game at Gen Con. Was it a different feel doing it at a gaming convention? If people don't know, Gen Con's like the biggest gaming convention in the world. It's huge. Was it a different feel doing it for that crowd versus the like the film festival crowd? Or did you find you got a similar response?
Well, I actually wasn't able to make it to Gen Con myself in person. But we did have a screening at Outfest in LA. Okay. And it was sponsored by a community group called the LA Gaming Society.
Okay.
A lot of their members were in the theater. And it actually, it was my favorite screening so far because I could tell that there were gamers in the audience because they were reacting to all the little Easter eggs. And like, I could tell they all had played The Legend of Zelda Breath of the Wild. The reactions were really on point.
That's awesome.
Like, so it was kind of like, it works for a general audience.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
If you've never played a video game, but it just felt so like there was like this real deep level of like immersion and understanding.
Yeah.
And it was really validating to know that it hit on that level. And like similarly at some of the Tribeca screenings, like I didn't know at the time during one of the screenings, but afterwards on Twitter, I saw like someone in the speedrunning community who's screen name I recognize was like, I was just at the screening. This was a great film.
Oh, so cool.
Really genuine. And I was like, oh my gosh, I can't believe you were there. Like, I know who you are.
Yeah.
Like, so it's been nice to like hear from these people. And they're like, we had a screening in Denver and someone came up to me. It was like, I backed the Kickstarter campaign. And I like, I'm actually picked Narcissa up from the airport in 2012 and took her to a gaming convention.
Oh,
so like,
that's so cool.
There's so many gamers out there. Like, it's not like some small niche.
No, it's huge.
And
yeah.
It's been really cool when people reveal themselves as like a big Zelda nerd and say that they enjoyed the film.
That's awesome.
That's great.
And what great validation to know that like this area that you're going into making a documentary about, it's being received in a very genuine way by the people that it's sort of about. You know, this gaming community is like, oh, she really took the time to understand what this is and like show it in a genuine way. I think that's awesome.
It's meant a lot. And we actually just had a piece out in Nintendo Life magazine that came out today that speaks to a lot of the members on my crew, like our two composers, Jeff Brodsky and Jesse Novak, and our pixel artist Patrick Ackerman and animator Emily Wolver and sound designer Austin Miller. And they're all huge Zelda fans.
Oh, nice.
So they really brought that like authentic knowledge of what it means to like truly love this franchise.
That's awesome.
Into their creative contributions in the film. So it's been really great to see those contributions like recognized in like the layer of like authenticity that it brings to the film.
Yeah.
To be celebrated.
Nice.
That's fantastic. So how do you balance working on your own film while holding down a day job?
Honestly, I'm exhausted.
Yeah.
Tribeca was a few months ago and I'm honestly still recovering from the final sprint. Luckily, I did not have a day job. I don't know how I would have been able to handle the last few months of finishing the film. I had to take several breaks for my day job here and there. I had to take several like long breaks from the film. I've had to work like part-time jobs on top of jobs to pay members of the crew. Honestly, it's really not sustainable. And I think we're kind of at a point in this industry, like not just documentaries, but the whole film industry as a whole, where we're reckoning with how it's even possible to have a job in this industry and make art and be compensated appropriately and have like any level of balance in your life and fair wages, fair treatment. And I have to say, it's not on the documentary side. It's pretty bleak as well.
Mm-hmm.
I don't regret making the film at all, but I have only lost money in making of it.
Yeah.
So my hope is that the conversation that's really happening on a national and really public level in the narrative field will expand into the documentary realm to forge a sustainable path. Fortunately, I am lucky enough to have had multiple day jobs in the nonfiction television industry, which not only prepared me to make this film, but supported me financially throughout the process.
Yeah.
They're definitely different stories than what I like make my own films about. It's really, at the end of the day, a pretty great job to have where you can be creative and work with awesome people to tell important stories.
Yeah.
Great.
So is there a union that covers documentary filmmakers specifically, or would that be under like a director's guild or a writer? Well, I don't know if it'd be writers, but.
Well, the Writers Guild of America East actually does serve the documentary story producers and associate producers, and a number of nonfiction shops have gotten representation from the WGA. So I have worked at a few companies in the past that had been unionized by WGA. Therefore, I was able to get things like health insurance at those companies. And the hope is for more and more to follow suit.
Yeah.
But when it comes to actual nonfiction filmmaking, you know, I think it's something that everyone wants. It's just a challenge of how do you build that infrastructure when the deal making that goes into making documentary films is so different
from
narrative features, where you're getting paid often on the back end, or, you know, getting equity, or it's like me, like I'm doing multiple roles just to get it going. And I think it's harder to find like a framework. And I think what we really need are creative risks. Like, people take risks on films from earlier stages and invest in filmmakers and projects much earlier on so that artists can be paid from the get-go and also pay their crew from the beginning and not on the back end.
Right.
It's certainly a challenge. And I know I'm part of the Documentary Producers Association, and we are, that's definitely a topic of conversation in that group. It's certainly a puzzle.
Absolutely. For a film festival like the Tribeca Film Festival, what's the process like for getting your film into it?
It really helps to have people who are established on your side as advocates for your film, especially as a first-time filmmaker, and connecting with programmers directly if you can, because like thousands of people are applying to these festivals, especially festivals like Tribeca. And if you don't have an inside track, you're less likely to get noticed, which is kind of a challenging pill to swallow. And like, I guess, for example, like I did one of the Sundance labs. So when I was applying for Sundance, I had inside track to the programmers at Sundance. So they knew about the project because I'd gone through one of the lab programs. So they're tracking the project. Ideally, what you would want to do is to have a sales agent on board who has relationships with the programmers and are advocating for you. Right now, with the industry at where it is, it was impossible for me to get a sales agent. And I was not the only one at Tribeca. Like, if you went to all the Tribeca film pages for documentaries, very few of them had representation. But I was lucky enough to have a consulting producer, Josh Penn, who producer on 32 Sounds. He works with the Ross Brothers. He did Beasts of the Southern Wild, who I just, honestly, I cold emailed and I was like, you're the type of producer I want to work with. I don't have any money, but he agreed to be consultant on the film. And he sent me the contact information for one of the programmers at Tribeca. Meanwhile, I got an acceptance into True False, which is one of the premier documentary festivals in the United States.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, that would be cool, but I really want to get into Tribeca, especially because they have a games portion of their festival. So I was able to reach back out to the Tribeca programmer and say, like, we got this acceptance from True False. Is there any way you can look at this film? Let us know ASAP.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, he looked at it And within like a few days, I got the acceptance.
That's awesome.
Cool.
So really like reaching out, if you get one acceptance, using that to get into whatever your preferred festival is.
Yeah.
If possible, also ask for waivers. That'll give you a good sense of how interested a festival might be in your film. But there's so much competition. And while I have heard stories of like films that aren't being tracked getting into festivals, I feel like that's very rare for the top of the line festivals.
Well, we talked about the financial side of things, but what is the most challenging part of making your own documentary?
This is a tricky one because so much of it is hard.
Yeah.
So much on the first film, I think you're learning what it means to make a film making a lot of mistakes as you go and course correcting, willing to be flexible and not treat things as too precious. Just try things.
Yeah.
Like you're going to have to restructure in a documentary. You're going to have to restructure it a million times. It's just part of the process.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think really having the stamina to keep going because documentaries take a long time. Like I remember when it was 2 years, I was like, oh, I've been working on this for 2 years. I can't wait till I'm done. And people would be like, I've been working on my film for 10 years. Like, talk to me in a few years.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh God, I can't imagine that. You really have to be patient and willing to take the time, grapple with it.
Yeah. Well, conversely, do you have any moments from either working on the documentary or just your career in general that are like your favorite moment?
Well, one that just sticks out to me as far as making this film, one of my favorite moments was I started making the film with Narcissa. I was like, I thought I knew where the story was heading. I thought it was going to be like this big, like Rocky moment or like this comeback. And I'm like listening to the stream as I walk to the subway in Brooklyn. And I hear a Narcissa stream, D girl, I can't wait until you're here. And I like almost spat out my coffee because I knew that D girl was someone in her chat. And I like thought she was just like a follower or a friend. Yeah. I did not know she was a love interest. I was tracking someone else as a possibility, honestly, because there's so much going on. And it was just like this moment of pure surprise and like realizing I had no control over this whatsoever. And that can be scary, but it can also be like the best thing imaginable. So that's one moment where I was really, truly surprised, thrilled, and excited to figure out who is this person who's coming to my protagonist's apartment when she's like isolated, like what is this person going to be like? And kind of having that sense of discovery as a filmmaker was really exciting to me.
Yeah, that's really cool.
That is exciting. That's very cool. Well, we have one more question for you, Jane, before we start talking about our film. And that question is, what advice do you have for people who want to get into the industry to either make their own film or work on someone else's?
Never be afraid to fail. And this applies like over in a lot of different ways. I'm actually on a mission to get 100 failures or rejections this year. And I'm up to 93. Wow. I have a friend from a fellowship and we're in what we call the Losers Club.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you get rejected so many times by so many people all along the way. You have to like reframe the process so that a rejection is a win and not a loss, so that you can keep going and keep putting yourself out there. So whether that's reaching out to someone who you admire, whose work you admire, to, you know, find out more about what their career is like, or to see if they might be willing to help you in your process of making your own film. That proved really powerful for me. As I mentioned, like, you know, reaching out to the producer, Josh Penn.
Yeah.
I reached out to an editor, Joe Beshenkovsky, who I really admire, who worked on Brett Morgan films like Jane and Kurt Cobain Montage of Heck.
Yeah.
He took the time to like watch cuts and give me feedback. People are really willing oftentimes to be there, be an advocate for you, to help you along the way, because they receive that same kind of help. And you have to just open yourself up to the possibility that you might get ghosted, you might get rejected, but in those like 100 failures, you're going to get a few wins in there. So like, yeah, that's my biggest advice and like a practice that I'm going to continue.
Yeah.
I'm going to continue striving for failure in a high volume because that's really the only way to guarantee any success.
Let's get to our featured film. Today we're discussing 2018 thriller Searching. It was written by Anish Chaganti and Sev Ohanian and directed by Anish Chaganti. It stars John Cho, Deborah Messing, and Joseph Lee. So Susan Q, a quick breakdown. What's this movie about?
Yeah, so this movie starts out, first of all, what's really cool about this movie is that every single shot is through someone's screen, whether it's a laptop, a security camera, a news camera. So you never really see like a traditional shot of a movie, which is really, really interesting. And seeing all the ways they accomplish that is so cool. It's probably my favorite part. But we follow the story. It's David Kim and his daughter, Margot, and the mom, David's wife, passes away when Margot's fairly young. So then we see her childhood play out with her mom and her dad. And then we see present day with just her dad and sort of the changes that have happened. Margot, right near the beginning of the movie, disappears and they don't know where she is. She's missing for about 36 hours when her dad finally calls the police. The police can't find any leads at first. This detective, played by Deborah Messing, gets involved, and that's when it really takes off. And we see all the clues that they find for Margot to find out where she went are all through the internet, through her social media, through her just online activity, through different social media sites. So it's really interesting. It's like this whole whodunit, but all through technology and like being online and her online presence. So I think we're going to get more into the plot, but that's just the setup.
Yes. Yeah. And this is your official spoiler warning because it's going to be very hard to talk about this movie without spoiling.
Yeah, we're going to definitely spoil it. So
but let's get into it. So Jane, you chose this movie for us to watch. Why did you choose Searching?
I chose Searching because it was such an inspiration to me when making my own film. Yeah. As I mentioned, my first impulse was to put the film in the stream. And it seemed unfathomable at the time because I'd never really seen an example of that.
Yeah.
It was really hard to find like editors for my film. It was hard to like explain what it needed to feel like because I hadn't seen it before. And then I saw Searching and I was like, this is how it needs to be. It's possible and it's so cinematic. I suppose there have been other desktop films in the horror genre before, but this had such a human heart at the center of the story, even though it was told through kind of the lens of technology. It really is like the best example of a desktop film.
Yeah.
I also, my VFX supervisor, Andre Hsu, worked for the company Vasilevs that produced Searching.
Oh, cool.
He worked on actually some of the Russian translations and also worked on Profile. So, which actually happened to be a complete surprise. Like I knew Andre from when I was working at Will Smith's production company. We worked on the show together and I was like, will you work on my film? Like, it's going to be like Searching. He's like, oh, I know all the people who made Searching. One of the editors of Searching, I was in conversation with him to edit Break the Game. But the funding that I had like disappeared. So the conversation never went any further, but he since went on to direct the sequel Missing. So this film's like really special to me. There's just so much hidden in the screen. Like there's so many like little Easter eggs. Mm-hmm. I think it's just, you know, a real accomplishment.
Yeah. It's so interesting the whole time because I feel like pitching this idea, it's like, well, who's going to want to sit there and stare at a bunch of screens? But it doesn't feel like that way at all when you're watching it. It's kind of like when I was watching, this isn't really shot the same way at all, but Queen's Gambit, all the chess scenes, the idea of just sitting and watching someone play chess sounds boring, but the way they scored it and shot it was, it made it so interesting. And this was the same way, even their shot where they were just showing that screensaver that kind of waved around, the music behind it, I was like totally invested in watching that screensaver just because of the tension they built with it.
Yes.
They did such a great job.
Exactly. And they really like turn all of these little things that are just, you know, background things into pieces of a mystery. And that's what really I loved about the film, is that it also works just as a mystery story. And it's a fun thing to try to solve. Mm-hmm. Is like, what happened to the girl? You know, who did she talk to? What is really going on? And of course, all these, you know, every time the father, you know, and John Cho does a great job in the movie playing this desperate father. And a lot of this movie is just him staring at screens.
Yeah.
And it's
clicking
incredible.
On folders, clicking and on profiles. Like,
exactly. And it's never been so interesting to watch someone delete a file. Right. You know, it's like,
oh my God.
All of the emotion that you mentioned, Jane, behind it, you know, it really carries through the story. And they do such a good job establishing these characters and then letting them kind of go through hell in order to solve this mystery. It's just really, really well done. And it's a fun film. It's also fun to try to figure it out, right? Because every time Susan and I were talking through it, the whole movie, and be like, oh, I think it's this thing. Or it's like, oh, I bet it's that person did this. And I mean, we got pretty close to correct. I mean, there is the twist, and we did not get the twist.
No.
But once it was revealed that, okay, seriously, spoilers now. Once it was revealed that Vic, the police officer, was behind it, then we figured out right away, it's like, oh, it's probably her son, because she told us, you know, that foreshadowing earlier in the film of her protecting her son and like doing a crime to cover it up. And so I'm like, oh, I bet that's exactly what happened. And then that was right. But it's such a creative move film. And I think the gimmick by itself would be fine, because I've seen movies like that use a gimmick sort of similar to this. But the fact that they wrapped it in a fun mystery really helped make it work.
Yeah.
It really puts you in the perspective of the father, because you're literally in a window into like hit the way he's viewing the scenario. You are his cursor. You're invested in it. Like, the cursor has like a soul.
Yeah.
And you're looking for clues, and like, they're kind of there on the screen, but your attention's really being guided both like sonically and visually of where you should be looking on this like complex screen. So I really studied the film in that regard for my own work. It also has like infinite replayability, because like, I was watching it I've watched it a number of times. So I watched it again today. And when you go on the Detective Vic's Facebook page, you see like her banner. It says something like, a mother will do anything for her child.
Yeah.
Like, there's so much groundwork that's laid. So it's all there, so that when it comes to the end, it feels really satisfying.
Yeah.
And you're not so shocked of like not getting it, because you've been guided all along.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing with the film is like, I watched it a bunch of times. So I was like watching, but like, I was getting a text or something.
Yeah.
You can't text and watch this film, because you need to be paying attention. You need to read. And it makes the experience of watching it so much more engaging than so many like other films, where you can kind of, you know, play solitaire on your phone. You're not fully in it.
Mm-hmm.
You really have to pay attention.
Yeah. And it's so much more satisfying when you're paying attention the whole time. Because I remember there's one clue they plant at the beginning, and at the end, it's the same boy when he's going through her middle school contacts, and it's like, has a crush on Margot. And then you get to the end, and you're like, oh my God, that was the first contact he clicked on at the beginning. And then he just swiped past it. I was like, so many moments like that, which are so satisfying in a mystery movie. And like, even the points where like, oh, I think we have this figured out. It wasn't so far ahead of the revelation where it felt like, oh, we already figured it out. This is dumb. It's like, oh my God, this is what it's going to be. And then they revealed it. It was just so well done and well timed.
Yeah. And I love how the film sort of escalates, because you know what's going to happen at the beginning of the movie. You know this girl is going to go missing, but you see all the dad make all these mistakes of, he doesn't start looking for her because he assumes that she's on this trip, or assumes that she's at this other thing. And there's such human mistakes, but then you can sort of watch him sort of deal with that guilt. And it's really just a week of their lives. But I love the beginning montage of this film that establishes these characters. And it's sort of like the beginning of Up, where it's like a really heartfelt first 15 minutes to establish who these characters are and really pull in the heartstrings. And then you get to get a very intimate but fast look at their lives. And then you're off into the mystery, which I thought was a really clever way to set up the story.
Yeah. And I think in like a different mode of filmmaking, it could be like very kind of cliche to get like all 10 years of a family's life, but it works really well of showing you where this family's at without without telling you in a really like familiar and relatable way. Like everyone knows like of a certain generation, like my generation, like what it's like to get your first computer and have your account and set it up and like developing technological independence, sort of having like different family profiles on the computer and like these shared moments. I do it in such a way that feels really realistic.
Yeah.
And it's not too like overproduced or glossy. Like it feels like, oh, we're really watching this, this family video from like 2008 or
yeah.
It's one of my favorite openings to a film that I can really think of.
With the first time you watched it, Jane, did you figure out the mystery?
No, I don't think I thought like maybe the police, the detective was in on it somehow, but it was such a jaw-dropping moment.
Yeah.
You see that memorial image with the stock photo of fish and chips and you're like, what the hell?
Yeah,
you shout like, it. It all clicks into place. And it's just so eerie when you like see the reverse image search and it's like,
yep.
That actress in like every like corporate version, waitress version, all the different versions. That was such like a jaw-dropping moment.
Yeah.
Really satisfying.
You literally got to solve it with him in that moment because you're watching every click, every search, you know, everything he reveals, you're seeing it on the screen. So yeah.
And, you know, I mean, there's some suspension of disbelief with the movie because, of course, in real life, the police would not let the family do all this, you know, investigating.
But she was probably letting him because she wanted to be able to steer him, right? Because she was trying to cover up for her son.
Well, I would think it would be easier if you just didn't let him do it at all. But regardless, it's still a fun story.
It's a good distraction.
It made the movie work. And so I very much enjoyed it. And I thought, super fun.
It was really good.
Really enjoyable watch. So, Jane, do you have a favorite scene in the film?
I really like the scene where John Cho discovers his daughter Margot's Ustream. Or UCast account. And is kind of catching up with a daughter who he's lost touch with. And there's so much emotion in just like these really banal streams of a teenager. And it's not even so much about the investigation anymore, but of like, who is his daughter? What happened to their relationship? And you just feel so much. Like you don't see John Cho in those moments, but you can tell what he's feeling.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So for me, that's like where the film is really more than just a like whodunit mystery, but has this really human relationship behind it.
Mm-hmm.
Susan, do you have a favorite scene?
There's a lot of scenes I really like. I mean, that one's great. I love the scene where he's finally figuring out the stuff about the detective. And then honestly, just in terms of like the format they chose, I do really love that scene where it's just the screensaver with the music behind it. I think just thinking about how interesting they made something that's that benign and that like just every day, it was just really interesting and just a testament to the level of filmmaking they were putting into this movie about screens, I think was cool.
Yeah, totally.
The score really helps with that film, I think. Like that piano melody from Margot's like piano lessons and the different riffs on it really guides you through the film really nicely.
Yeah. Did you have a favorite scene?
It's so weird to say this, but I enjoyed watching him on the computer trying to like doing the searching, if you will, or doing, you know, the investigating of him clicking around on stuff and figuring stuff out. Because your points, you could actually sort of feel the way he's feeling as you're watching him go through this stuff and he's deleting stuff or he's moving stuff around depending on how it makes him feel. But I think that's so cleverly done and it really takes you into the character's head rather than just showing you, you know, an action. It really like takes you through that thought process. And yeah, to your point, Jane, it makes you feel for the characters and a real rooted relationship more so than just, you know, watching somebody do something, which is what a typical movie would do. This one does a very different and it really works. We'd like to finish up our show today with a game that we're calling Movie Verbs. In honor of searching, we're going to see how well both of you know the titles of famous movies. So Jane, you'll be playing against Susan. So here are the rules. I'm going to read the title of a well-known film, but I've removed a verb from the title. Whoever shouts out the correct verb first will earn a point. I have 9 movies for you to identify, and whoever gets 5 correct will win our prize. And Susan, what's our prize?
Just some Life in the Credits merchandise, like a shirt or a mug or a tote bag, something like that.
Something like that.
Very high stakes game.
Yes.
Yeah.
All right, Jane, are you ready to play?
I am ready.
All right, Susan, are you ready?
Ready.
All right, here we go. Number one. Blank Miss Daisy.
Driving.
Yes. Jane, you're on the board with 1 point. Well done. Number two. How to blank a guy in 10 days.
Lose.
Yes, Susan. Yeah. Very good. 1-1. Number three. Who blanked Roger Rabbit?
Framed.
Yes. All right. 2-1. Number four. Blank Bill.
Kill.
Yes. Oh. Well done, Jane. 2-2. Kill Bill is correct. Number five, blank Sarah Marshall.
Forgetting.
Yes, oh. Forgetting Sarah Marshall's correct.
I forgot the name of that movie for a second.
3-2, Jane's in the lead. Number six, blank Nemo.
Finding.
Yes.
Got that one.
Susan ties it up with
that was close.
Three. Number seven.
3-3.
Sorry to blank you.
Father.
Yes.
Oh,
phenomenal job, Jane. That was a hard one.
That movie is crazy.
That movie is crazy.
Love that movie.
Yeah, it's so good.
4-3. All right, we got 2 left.
Okay.
If Jane gets another point, she wins.
Okay.
Blank in the Rain.
Singing?
Yes, Susan. Very good. Singing in the Rain. All right, so
it's tied.
Tied up at 4 each. Whoever gets this one will win today's game. Number 9. Blank me if you can.
Catch.
Yes. Oh. And just like that, Jane has pulled it off. Well done.
Congratulations. That was Thank pretty you. Good. That was
I'm
a good game.
Excited for the sweat.
Yeah.
That's a good one.
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad you guys enjoyed it. And well done, Jane. That was close.
Congratulations.
I like a game where the answer can't be Koyaanisqatsi.
Well, before we let you go, Jane, is there anything that you would like to plug?
I would like to plug Break the Game. We are having we're still on our festival run. We're playing at a lot of festivals. So I would recommend following our Instagram, Break Game Movie, and same on the website formerly known as Twitter, and Facebook to stay up to date on festival screenings and other screening events as we roll out the film and distribute it both in person and all over the internet.
Nice.
Fantastic. Well, we can't wait to see
it. Yeah. We'll have to keep an eye out for the screenings. Well, thank you for joining us. This was awesome.
Yeah. Thank you, Jane.
Of course.
Life in the Credits is hosted and produced by me, Susan Swarner.
And me, Ben Bloom.
It's executive produced by Michelle Levin.
The music is written and performed by Steve Trowbridge. You can hear more of Steve's music at TrowbridgeSounds.com.
The show logo is created by Melissa Durkin.
If you'd like to support Life in the Credits and get access to exclusive perks, you can do so at Patreon.com.
If you'd like to follow or get a hold of us, you can find us on Facebook and Instagram at Life in the Credits or shoot us an email at lifeinthecredits@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.
Forgetting Sarah Marshall's correct.
I forgot the name of that movie for a second.